listening to Pythagoras' Trousers.
Hello and welcome to this month's Pythagorean Astronomy with me, Chris North.
And me, Edward Gomez.
Well, it's been a couple of months since we did a news roundup, so we've got a few things to talk about. One that's been in the news quite recently, one of our colleagues here in Cardiff was involved. This is a study of an exoplanet, so a planet about 120 light years away, going around a small red dwarf star, I think. The planet is about just under the size of Neptune, so a few times bigger than the Earth. We don't have planets like this in our solar system. And it's thought to be maybe a water world with a water-covered ocean, just because of the elements you expect to be there on the planet. But the big questions about these planets remain, because we don't see anything like it. We see Neptune with the icy core and then the methane-rich atmosphere, but Neptune is tens of times further from the sun than the Earth is, whereas this planet is in what's called the habitable zone. It's in the nice sort of the Goldilocks zone around its star. It's quite amazing to think of water worlds, isn't it? And what they might be like. They're in science fiction, but maybe they're not fiction.
Yeah, and the thing that we should note is that although it's billed as a water world, we haven't got direct evidence. So the way that things like this are worked out normally is that you work out what the size of the planet is, and you work out what the mass of the planet, and you come up with an average density, and then you model what possible arrangement of gas, water, or liquids, and rock could produce that average density. And the one that fits is a water world for this one. But there could be some other weird thing that we haven't thought of, but that's the one that fits best. But yeah, forming a water world is quite a mystery. And like you say, we don't have things like that in our solar system. Earth is probably the closest that we have with its large oceans. It's very interesting seeing this, because it has, with water worlds, you have the possibility or the potential of life in terms that we understand it. It's life that evolves from oceans. So when we're looking at these type of planets, we're looking for biomarkers. So things that you can see from space that would indicate that there is or has been extraterrestrial life. It could just be bacterial or microbial life, but some sort of life, something from the process of respiration normally. And this planet has one of those.
Yeah, well, maybe. It's tentative. It's very much a maybe. This is observations with JWST, the James Webb Space Telescope, which has been up there getting on 2 years at the end of this year, its infrared instruments have revolutionized some of these observations. And whereas previously the Hubble Space Telescope, which for a long time the best space telescope we had, had picked up maybe tentative signs of water vapor in the atmosphere of this planet, and actually these latest results have said no, it's not water vapor, it's methane. So that's, here it's natural gas, but we know there's a lot of that around in solar systems in general. It's quite an easy molecule to form with carbon and hydrogen, and then CO2, carbon dioxide. So that is interesting, because it tells you a little bit about the atmosphere. The fact that there's no water vapor means that it's not got this sort of steam covered world, which you might think if it was too hot. So there are implications that maybe that says it's got clouds and hazes and so on. Again, we don't have pictures of this. This is all models of atmospheres that are atmospheres we don't have anything like here in our solar system, let alone here on Earth. So it's not just like the Earth with a slightly deeper ocean. You know, it's much more different than that, it seems. But what they have found as well is a very, very tentative sign of something called dimethyl sulfide, or DMS to its friends, maybe. And maybe this does mean, maybe I say friends, maybe there are friends here. This is the dimethyl sulfide on Earth is only produced by life. We don't know of a way of producing, because it gets broken down by other processes. Now, it's a very tentative detection. They're looking for more data with other instruments and more data with these same instruments on JWST to kind of get more proof or otherwise of this. Maybe the detection will go away. But it is very interesting that, you know, it implies that there could be probably microbial life floating in this ocean if it indeed is indeed a water world.
Yeah, which is quite exciting if it all pans out. I mean, the results are a little bit hazy no pun intended, because the graphs that they've produced, the way that they've fitted their model to the data, is just on the edge of what you'd consider scientifically rigorous, but still tantalizing.
Of course, the other possibility, this is memories for people who remember the phosphine detection on Venus, which is still there and being analysed and predicted. One of the big conclusions from that is that phosphine maybe indicates microbial life, bacterial life in the atmosphere of Venus, but also possibly could be some interesting chemistry that we've not we don't understand yet. And the same is true here. We think the proposal that it's microbial life or some simple form of life is because we don't know a way of keeping this molecule there, of replenishing it when it gets broken down by sunlight or starlight and so on. But maybe there's some other way of producing it that we've not considered yet. I don't want to put a dampener on this, but it might go away and it might not be as exciting as life. It might be interesting chemistry, which is fascinating to the chemists. Close to home in our solar system, also some interesting studies, kind of related, to Europa. So Europa is this moon of Jupiter. It's about the size of our moon, but it's not made primarily of rock. It's made primarily of ice and water, of course, melted ice. Europa is this world that's got this icy crust. And we know from measurements the way it rotates and the way its surface seems to move around that it has a subsurface ocean. So beneath probably a very thick ice layer, there's this subsurface ocean. But there have been hints that over the years that maybe there have been plumes of water vapour coming out from this ocean through cracks in this ice. And the fact that you could get this water and then anything in the water, be it minerals or microbes or whatever, getting to the surface is also very interesting for going to sample this. So what's the latest that we've seen on this?
So this is another JWST discovery or observation. And Europa is an extremely interesting world. It's obviously, it's not a planet. It's a moon going around Jupiter. It's about the size of our moon, but it has this, again, tantalizing property that it potentially has life because of all this water. Now, like you said, Chris, the water is very deep. Underneath a thick layer of ice. It's not, you know, like a pond that's thick. It's several miles. I think it's probably about between 10 and 15 miles of ice. And then there's water underneath. So the life that would be down there would be substantially different to the way that life formed on Earth. But through these cracks, JWST has detected carbon dioxide. And we know that carbon dioxide is, there are these, I think, six elements that occur in on Earth that we consider essential for life. And Europa has four of them, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, and potentially sulfur as well. Although the idea that sulfur is on Europa, it might actually have been from one of Jupiter's other moons, Io, which has volcanic eruptions. It might have traveled through space and landed on Europa. But this carbon dioxide is real, and it's actually from the lower regions of the surface, so from this water layer, and it's crept up through cracks and been observed by JWST.
I guess there are two things this confirms. I mean, the plumes of water vapor have been kind of tentative, but this kind of confirms that if it really is from beneath, and they think it's been laid down recently, it's not from impacts of meteorites and asteroids and so on, that there is some movement of material from deep down to on top. So that does mean we could potentially go and sample that, or at least study it from orbits. The Europa Clipper mission, the JUICE mission, which are going there they're going to be a few years yet. It also means that there have been question marks about whether that subsurface ocean was in contact with a rock layer. Because Because just having water on its own possibly isn't that great for life, because you need minerals. You don't just need hydrogen and oxygen in water, you need other stuff as well. But the fact that there's carbon coming up implies that, and there have been evidence of salts and other things on the surface before, that this ocean is in contact with a mineral layer at the bottom. So the idea is kind of the black smokers that are discovered 40-odd years ago here on Earth by deep ocean vents. Maybe you get processes like that at the bottom of this ocean. So it's all really tentative. All of these discoveries, even if each one on its own isn't that groundbreaking, they all seem, with Europa, they all seem to point in the same direction, don't they? It's going to be really fascinating when Europa Clipper and then JUICE take observations of it in a few years' time.
Yeah, definitely one to watch.
Let's move further afield by a few billion light years and go out of the solar system, and we're looking now at distant galaxies, particularly one that where the light has taken 11 billion years to reach us, which, given the universe is only just under 14 billion years old, it's from very early on in the universe's history. It's only 2.5 billion years old at the time. Now these galaxies normally are pretty small to observe. They're normally a pinprick on an observation, even with some of the most powerful telescopes. But this one has been magnified. Its view has been distorted by the presence of another galaxy in the foreground, this thing called gravitational lensing, where the mass of this foreground galaxy warps the light from behind, and we get this magnified view of this very, very distant galaxy. And what observations, what astronomers have done with the ALMA telescope, which is a very, very large ground-based radio telescope, down in the Atacama Desert in Chile, is they've managed to map the magnetic fields in this galaxy. We know galaxies have magnetic fields. Our own galaxy has a magnetic field, and we can measure that in nearby galaxies. But we've done this in a galaxy billions of light years away, the most distant thing we've ever done it with. And the prospects this raises for having to do this and study magnetic fields early on in the universe. I mean, magnetic fields are a bit of a conundrum in generally in astronomy. It's the joke is that everyone asks if you consider the effect of magnetic fields in talks. And I don't know, Edward, have you ever considered the effects of magnetic fields?
Well, not particularly. I'm a stellar astronomer, so not particularly in galaxies. But The interesting thing about magnetic fields, like you say, it is a bit of a conundrum because nobody really understands what forms them. They think it's, generally the stuff that's in the galaxy. But further than that, it's very difficult to know. People think it's linked to star formation, so stars being born. And because this galaxy is so far back in the history of the universe, that could give a really nice indication about star formation that early on in the universe. So this discovery of magnetic fields, and actually this really clear observation, it gives quite a nice picture of the inner workings of a galaxy, and not just a picture of the surface of it.
Yeah, and as you say, it's this star formation, this churning of material, which is thought to generate these magnetic fields. But beyond that, it's a little bit uncertain as to what exactly is going on there, going on in more detail than that. Hopefully there's lots more discoveries of magnetic, or analysis of magnetic fields, and it's kind of a proof of concept that you can do this with ALMA. I mean, we talked about JWST and the discoveries that's allowing. Well, ALMA has been doing that for years now. Just every couple of months there's a groundbreaking discovery of a new thing that ALMA can do, which is really revolutionising what we can do in astronomy. So whether it's potential signs of life or the inner workings of galaxies in the distant universe, these telescopes are really changing the way we understand things. Bringing us back much closer to home, and not quite all the way home yet, but in a couple of days, this story gets, as we record it, this story gets very, very local. This is the OSIRIS-REx mission. So that is a NASA mission that's been to the asteroid Bennu, and it's coming home.
Yeah, so this is a wonderful feat of spaceflight that... This mission was sent out to Bennu, which Bennu is arguably the most hazardous asteroid to the Earth because it's big. It's I think it's about 500 meters across. And
so it'd make a bang if it hit the Earth.
It would make a bang if it hit the Earth. And it's also an Earth-crossing asteroid. So its path takes it across the orbit of Earth as it goes around the sun. So that's really one to watch, and one to watch very carefully. And actually, projections think that there could be an impact from Bennu in the next 100 years. So that's a reason to study this asteroid. So one of the things that this mission did was collect a sample from the asteroid and sort of scooped up a bit of the asteroid. But interestingly, as they got close to the asteroid, as the spacecraft got close, the jets that were keeping it stable made a huge crater, because the asteroid was actually not a solid body. It's a, what we call a rubble pile asteroid, which is a collection of essentially gravel rocks of different sizes that are gravitationally bound. So it looks spherical, but only because there's enough stuff to make it gravitationally attract itself. And out in space, you can do that. That will tell us all sorts of interesting things when we get back to the lab, what the asteroid, a potential impact from the asteroid would be like. But also this will give us a really nice view into the formation of the planets, particularly the rocky planets. You can analyze meteorites once they've passed through the atmosphere, but they've been contaminated by the Earth's atmosphere at that point. So you're scooping up something which is pristine then with this asteroid. And yeah, I'd be very interested to see what it has on board.
Yeah, I guess for OSIRIS-REx, the mission to Bennu was to study what this asteroid is made of, and that guides how, if we did need to deflect it, how we might best deflect it, because deflecting a solid rock versus a rubble pile, as you say, is a different challenge. I don't know whether it's thought there could be a solid thing in the centre or something, and rubble is collected onto it. I guess there's no, you can't really tell.
Possibly.
Unless you blow the thing apart, which is probably not a good idea.
Yeah.
But the sample return, I guess, is, as you say, this pristine sample is a kind of a scientific curiosity-led thing. That's not going to tell us how to deflect the asteroid or anything, but it does give us those real pristine samples of stuff that the Earth would have formed from, you know, 4.5 billion years ago. And as you say, it's kind of the only way of doing this. And the real challenge is getting it back to Earth. This thing is moving at tens of thousands of kilometers per hour through space. The you know, you think it's bad enough with astronauts coming back from the space station or the moon with their heat shields and their parachutes and so on. This thing is going several times faster at least than that. It's a bit smaller than an astronaut capsule, of course, but it's got heat shields and parachutes. And there's not the track record of catching these things is patchy, I think it's fair to say. So was it Genesis, which was a solar sample that was meant to get caught by a helicopter on its way down and plummeted into the desert in the United States, I think. They got a few bits out of it. Was it Stardust? Brought some samples back from the tail of a comet. And then Hayabusa are the big Hayabusa and Hayabusa 2 are the big sample returns from Japan that have been to asteroids. Hayabusa 2 has dropped off some samples from Ryugu, which is a similar sort of size asteroid to Bennu as well. So we're now getting more of these samples, and fingers crossed, as we record this, we're a couple of days away from when this thing gets back to Earth. So fingers across, the heat shield, the parachutes, they all work, and these samples can be recovered and analysed in labs. Keep your eyes peeled for results.
Yeah, extremely interesting to see if it works. They have had a dry run of it, so but obviously it's not going to be moving as fast as the real thing.
And I'm delighted to say that a couple of days later, we got confirmation that the OSIRIS-REx capsule had indeed made it safely down to the surface of the Earth. It was picked up, shipped to a clean room where it had a nitrogen atmosphere purged through it, and is whizzing its way off to the labs for those all-important samples to be preserved and then analysed in the cleanest possible environment. We'll get results from that in coming weeks. That's it for this month. My thanks to Edward. Don't forget, you can find past episodes and subscribe to the podcast at pythagastro.uk. You can also find us on Spotify. Just search for Pythagorean Astronomy. Until next month, goodbye.
Goodbye.
You've been listening to Pythagorean Astronomy, an extended version of this month's Astronomy Roundup from Pythagoras' Trousers, a weekly science and technology radio show presented by me, Rhys Phillips. You can catch up on full episodes of Pythagoras' Trousers, subscribe to our podcast, and get in touch by going to www.pythagoras-trousers.radio.fm.